Hey, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, I'm okay, Sex and Jacks. Now, come on, Ricky on the board. S&P futures are up like 12 bucks, not much after yesterday's huge down day. So we have all kinds of things going on today. We have people worried about the subprime market, which is in the news. We've got crazy stuff like people being able to buy Russian oil now, our bitter enemy supposedly, because there's not enough oil coming out of the strait. I can't believe that's happening, but it is. We have a lot of stuff going on there. We have the amount of money being spent by the Treasury is reaching incredible proportions. We're talking, you know, $50 billion a month they're borrowing, or some huge number, or a week, man. I don't even, you know, whatever. But do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, you do. Good morning.
How are you? Hey, I have a. Well, we have stuff to talk. We also, if we get a free moment, the new valuation of the Major League Baseball teams came out that we could talk about a little bit, but. Hey, you know, I'm going to talk to Carl, and maybe he'll pile in a little earlier or something, talking about this subprime market stuff. And, of course, Deutsche Bank, well, not of course, if you didn't read it, it came out yesterday and had a big warning about how it's taken some places down, subprime lending here in the U.S. And Jamie Dimon, I think, at J.P. Morgan, just wrote off a bunch. I don't know, I should get the number. Maybe Carl has it. They just wrote off some stuff where they loan to subprime lenders. And, Kevin, what is... I'll just give a kind of a generic sort of thing, how people, especially people in power and CEOs and people, they're supposed to be there. You know, as my mother said once, a wise lady, she goes, you know, you hire these people and you pay them all this money, and you give them all this stuff, and everybody knows you don't need them on a day-to-day basis. Everybody else runs the place. But every once in a while, when you get in trouble or if something unusual comes up, they're supposed to have this extra talent that nobody else has, and they're going to provide something that nobody else can do. Either more often than not, when that day comes, you find out they got nothing. And I don't know if it was my mother's Southside view on life, but I think that's somewhat accurate. in a lot of cases, they...
Say that again. Is that, I mean, you're defining the role of CEO as to be around to just respond whenever something crazy?
No, I'm saying it's supposed to be something that nobody else can cover. You're a cut above. You know, you're not going to help people turn the wrench on the car, but you're going to make the strategic decisions that the other people aren't capable of making. Whenever there's a time of crisis that nobody expects, you're supposed to have something above everybody else and steer the place through the crisis that nobody else could.
Yeah, but Here's the deal. If you're the strategist, if you're responsible for strategy, then for the most part, sometimes you have to make decisions in crisis mode that you might not make and that aren't going to advance you towards your strategy. But otherwise, your job is to make sure that the decisions made, even in crisis, are the ones that fit within the strategy. And when you set the strategy, you're also setting the boundaries. You know, it's what your company is and what your company isn't. Those are all big parts of it. But I don't see the CEO's job is to be the brilliant person when things go wrong, who all of a sudden comes up with a strategy on the fly.
Okay.
That doesn't sound.
Well, I mean,
like
the idea is you're supposed to have.
Am I rephrasing what you're saying? Correct.
A little bit. The idea is you're supposed to have an above the ground view of the world that other people don't have. You're getting paid a real lot for something. What's the something? I guess is the question.
You know, when you have, and this is really at all levels of management, when you have some kind of a crisis, your job as the leader is to get everybody together. Draw out, you know, the ideas that you have from different people, and then to And then to, you know, set the, okay, here's what we're going to do and keep everybody on track to do it. That's more the leadership role. Think of, you know, Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's not the guy who came up with the response without having a whole lot of people in the room.
I understand that, but he was also able to listen to people and draw stuff out of it. I'm saying, my point is, when you look at the Fed, where I'm going with this stuff, I'm trying to get the management reason why maybe we are stuck in this subprime thing yet again. I mean, when you look at the crisis in 2007, the moderately brainwashed populace, which includes, you know, me to a certain extent, is going to say, oh, man, these banks gave a mortgage to somebody who didn't deserve it and blah, blah, blah. And it's really, and that's the level that most people can understand, okay? But really, the problem, the extent of the crisis was because there was $35 of equity on every dollar of mortgage. It was stacked up on top of stacked up. Now, how could that even be? We're talking 6.5%, 7% rates. Why would somebody kill himself to make 6.5% or 7%? Because people were borrowing the money in Japan at 2% or 1%, bringing it over here and buying. Kevin, even you and I, if we put $1 million up, borrowed $40 million at 2% and lended it out at 6.5% or 7%, even you and I can make money doing that, right? It's called leverage. Well, there's the other part of the transaction, though. We had to take the yen into dollars, and when we go back the other way to get it done, we have to turn the dollars back into yen, and the interest rate differential should be in the forward, and we're just not doing that piece of the train. Well, my point is, you and I are not capable, even in the business I'm in, we're not capable of keeping track of those money flows. Now, the Fed is, because every dime that flies back and forth across the water, they know about. Right? So, somewhere along the line, they should have said, gee, where's all this dough coming from, and why is it that Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs are selling mortgage bond portfolios that are synthetic? They don't have enough mortgages to put in them because everybody wants them. It got so strange. You sit there and go, how could these guys have been surprised? Well, now, fast forward to the response to all that stuff. We buttoned down the banks. I say we, the U.S. of A. We buttoned down what banks are doing for people, trying to get a small business loan out of a bigger bank, trying to get a subprime loan. They'll give you a credit card, maybe, God knows what percent. And so we essentially have taken the banks out of this. Part of it is they don't want to do it. They just want to lend money to big people. But part of it, they're not set up to do it. I mean, Lakeside Bank is where I bank. They've sponsored the show from time to time. I mean, if you walk over there for a car loan, well, they'll give me one because I'm a good client. They don't have a car loan department anymore. I mean, they don't even like that. I mean, 40 years ago, if you got a car, you might have gone to the bank and got your loan if you're a customer. So now all of a sudden, we've chased these. We know people are going to fill in the gap. Somebody's going to loan money to the plumber for his third vehicle, even though the bank won't. Somebody is going to do this, not big shot, call it subprime lending. Now the question is, who's going to do it? And now you got to find out who the hell's doing it. Now if the banks, of course, are not, they won't lend money to the plumber, but they're going to lend a whole bunch of money to somebody who's going to lend the money to the plumber. It kind of gets you to the same place, right, except with one more finger in the pie. So they should be the people that anticipate this. I mean, you and I must get, Kevin, securities firm, PTI Securities, I probably get 4 to 5 emails a week of people wanting to lend us dough. And once in a while, one of the morons will call, and I'll say, you know, you're talking to a securities firm. Oh, yeah, we know that. I said, well, you really do realize that a securities firm, we can't borrow money from you. Well, why not? I said, because if you knew anything about a securities firm, which you're pestering all the time, if I can lend money to PTI because I'm a partner, a big partner. Somebody else, you can't lend money to PTI until you become a partner. Otherwise, the loan is considered a liability, and there's no capital infusions. So if we borrowed $20 million from you, we're broke. I mean, most people. I said, don't you guys even know that? Oh no, why would we know something like that? So I get one this week, Kevin. Guess how much they wanted for interest, depending on our situation. 1 to 3% a month. 3% a month? Holy bleep! So, I mean, this obviously has been going on. Like, when you and I were kids watching the Cubs play, it was household finance before they became became bought by the bank, right? They were the subprime. There's always somebody doing it. And it's the Fed's job to kind of keep an eye on where this is all going, because it's part of, you know, the fabric. Somebody's going to get to these people. Who's the somebody? Is it Chief. Small banks? I mean, what is the job of these people other than to kind of monitor this stuff?
Chief, look. I sent around to the list the thing that the processor that I use for my tiny little contributor thing sent me. You remember that one, right?
Yeah.
Just a few days ago, okay? They send me these things about once a month. Okay, here. Based upon your transaction volume, we'd like to offer you a working capital loan. They don't call it interest. It's just a 20% upfront charge.
Yeah.
Plus, by the way, we're going to attach 20% of your gross before the discount charge on your tickets. Okay. How to go bankrupt in one easy step.
But now, I guess the question...
Here's...
is you're talking about companies that are outside the banking system, so they're not regulated in the same way.
They are, but they're not. But see, Kevin, here's the problem with this. Okay, this is supposedly what we put the boot that we supposedly stomped on, right? Because if you remember, Countrywide was a mortgage lender.
Yeah, also outside the system. Yep,
which was allegedly outside the regulated banking system.
Except that you had all kinds of banks treasurers buying their securities because they couldn't fill out their loan portfolio.
They had this
crazy thing going on, especially with a lot of the SNLs that were still still around at the time, thinking, I want my portfolio to look more like a commercial bank's with a lot of commercial lending on there, because that's going to be much, much more stable, so they think. But in the meantime, they have to make mortgages because they're not filling up their loan portfolio. They're laying them off on companies, whether it's Fannie and Freddie or whether they're selling blocks to Countrywide, and then they're turning around and buying the securities in the same system. So they're just screwing themselves. You know, they're saying, I'm laying off the risk by selling them, and then I'm buying back the risk by buying the risk, you know, buying the securities of the very people who bought the mortgages from me.
Well, and that's the essence of the scam, okay? Is that the entire reason this thing is done through such a channel? Because as I've pointed out repeatedly, as you've pointed out, Kevin, and Hal's brought this up too, for that matter. The lowest cost loan to everyone is, if I've got $1 million and you wish to borrow $1 million, that you and I sit down over a beer at the bar, we go over your financials, we come up with some set of terms, and you and I shake hands and I give you the money. Okay? Why? Because there's only two people involved in it. And therefore, the only person who has to make a profit is me. There's no one else. I don't have to pay for a building.
Although ideally, then I will use the capital to make a profit too. But keep going.
Well, you better. Otherwise, I lose my shirt, right? Because you can't pay me back.
Because I'm not going to pay you back. And then the next question is, how well reserved are you?
but you can't. If you can't pay, then then allegedly, at least, I seize your assets. And by the way, I'm supposed to have done my diligence to know that if that happens, I could at least, be reasonably made whole. All right,
Carl. A couple questions.
But now here's the problem, Chief. As soon as the more people you put in the middle of, that nice bank building on the corner, it didn't get built by Harry Potter's magic wand. All right, and neither did the 400 people that are sitting in that tower. They didn't get paid that way either. All right, now. The entire reason you've got this crap going on, and now Deutsche Bank has this, this so-called private credit risk, It was a Reuters story out of.
Well, it's the news all over the air. I was on Joel's show yesterday.
Yeah, but I mean, Well, this particular article hit the tape yesterday morning. Okay. But it's not the first one because Diamond's been talking about it too, and so is everybody else. All right. Here's the thing. These are supposedly regulated entities. Deutsche Bank is a regulated entity. JP Morgan is a regulated entity.
Well, that's my point. Yeah.
Yeah. Once are we going to throw one of these people in prison?
Well, I mean, it's okay until things go bad, right?
Except it's not. Okay.
Well, answer me this. This is the part that I could not find last night or this morning. If the three of us, Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe go out and raise a whole bunch of capital and start lending it to people at, you know, subprime rates, regular rates, whatever it is, if we're essentially a private bank and we're not in the FDIC, we're not anything, but people just gave us $50 million to go out and lend money to people, it's kind of on us, right? But if the banks won't give the loans, and we say that's our business, and the bank then loans us the $50 million, so they're one step away. And I couldn't figure out how much of the risk is in loans from banks or just capital that these people have on their own.
Well, the basic problem is that the entire premise of what all these people are doing and what they've been doing and the entire point of this, if you will, over all this time, has been to allegedly not have that risk as theirs, right? I mean, that is the point.
To make it simple, if the three of us borrow $20 million and give out $20 million loans to plumbers, and the plumbers all go under, it shouldn't affect anybody else at all, right? But it looks like it's going to.
but it does, because what they do is they lie.
Well, they also must get loans from somebody.
Well, I understand that, but the point is this. The entire reason this is now, quote-unquote, in the news, here's the thing. Why is this now in the news?
Well, that's a good question. That's why we're talking about it this morning.
Right. Why hasn't this exposure been in every quarterly report for the last 5 years?
Why didn't the amount of money being borrowed from Japan in 2007 become news until it did?
Well, okay. Why did WaMu? You know, I flagged this in the first quarter of 2007. It was the reason I started writing my blog.
Wait, who was the guy? You mentioned two places. Kevin did. Who was the guy that always came on TV with the incredible tan, with the dark blue shirt, with the white collar? Was that guy? Who was he with? He was with Countrywide, right?
Yeah, he was a crook.
Kevin, remind me of this. Didn't Countrywide sell mortgage insurance to like 40% of all the loans in California? How could they insure a state, for God's sake?
Well, that's the chief. That's the entire problem. Okay, we supposedly have a regulatory system that is supposed to. These aren't suggestions. These are laws.
Who actually?
Let's go a little bit further on how that works too, because what's going to happen is, first of all, if you're in the banking system, then you're going to be audited by, you know, a state regulator. You're going to be audited by the FDIC. The Federal Reserve is going to be. You're going to constantly have these safety and soundness exams. And so you know, your risk, your portfolio risk should be flagged in there. And in most of these cases, it's not just a matter of saying, well, you need to reserve a little more. You need to set a little more in your loan loss reserve because of the risk. In some cases, they really, really should be issuing cease and desist orders, and they don't.
Right. What happened?
On top of that, now you're going to turn around to your Countrywide types of companies and say, they're still regulated. There still are lending laws about what they're allowed to do. But the portfolio is not subject to a cease and desist order necessarily. But what they are subject to is annual audits, at least. And who the hell is signing off on their books?
Kevin, who
the public accounting firms are out to lunch on this.
Kevin, a quick question. Let me ask this question first, Carol. I think you've alluded a bunch of times that people that come in and do the banking audits pretty much know how to do a banking audit. I mean, I'm going to say the people who audit us and the SEC and all those places, they know what they're doing. I mean, and you know, it's a pain in the ass, but they do a good job, and we're always happy when we get done with it, and there's no problems. But what happens if Kevin's bank all of a sudden starts selling a credit default swap or selling mortgage insurance? How the hell do those guys, what do they do with that? That's not in their wheelhouse. I mean, how do they value a credit default swap on, say, Cyprus or something? I mean, what do they do? Do they kick that upstairs? They ignore it? It seems like it's always something new that creeps in.
Yeah, this is the essence of the issue, okay, is that this is not a question of discretion. The FDIC operates under, which of course applies to any bank that does business in the United States and has that sticker on the window. All right?
Yeah.
There is a law under which they operate called prompt corrective action. I wrote a crap ton of articles on this exact point. Prompt corrective action requires the federal government to stomp on this crap when this risk exposure exists. It does not allow them to say, well, these guys look like a good credit, so it's fine. They don't have that discretion.
I guess
it's not there.
My question was...
The word in that law, Chief, is shall.
I know, but I'm trying to ask Kevin here is, when you go off the reservation with something that isn't really your normal banking product, I think these guys would have trouble with that. I mean, I would.
Well no, really?
Yeah.
By the way, I have this box. I have this box. It's worth $100 billion, its contents. But you can't see inside it.
Yeah, well.
But it's worth $100 billion. Trust me.
Well, you know, things kind of tie together a little bit when you're hosting the show and you have all the different people. It's funny that when Lou was on talking about Epstein's plea bargain in Florida, and he said, you know, to most people, getting somebody to admit to being a registered sex offender is enough to kind of screw them for the rest of their life. Nobody want to be near the guy.
No, really?
He said, but in this case, it sort of didn't. And seemingly, in some of these, these banking transactions, you know, somebody being written up for something or whatever, seemingly would cause a problem, and people just do business with them anyway. I mean, it's sort of the same deal.
How many people still do business with Wells Fargo?
Yeah, well, that's
who has had scam scandal after scam scandal.
Well, when you're down
hey, let's just sign you up for some accounts you never actually asked for.
Well, when you're down to four or five banks, I guess, and they're the only one in town, where else do you go? I mean, that's a problem too, right? And
I don't know. There's two credit unions in my little town.
Well, but you guys are smart enough to find these out. I mean,
one of them, by the way, I do business with.
Well, okay, but I mean, Kevin has said a million times that in his area in Michigan and in Illinois, this is foreign to us because Illinois was the last state in the union to go allow even branch banking. You have one bank, one location. So there's all kinds of banks here. Now, I also, when I first went to San Francisco years and years ago, every time I walked down the block, I ran into the Wells Fargo office. Was it the only place there? It sure seemed like it. I mean,
I refused to do business with any of the large banks when I ran MCS in Chicago because they have a history of screwing people whenever things get tight, right? On the other hand, I somebody that I knew before I was an internet company, we did PCs and network installation and stuff like that, that got hosed during the early 1990s when there was a modest slowdown. They called his operating line, which by the way is a clause that's in most of those agreements that people don't read. Okay.
Well, I guess the question from the get-go before you came on was, in my opinion, I can get a bunch of people
what the Fed does on a daily basis is very hard to do, okay? But people just think all they do is make policy decisions. They don't. But the simple fact is, you're putting people in charge of this stuff to anticipate the next crisis, not to just blindly follow the last one. And it seems like every 10 years or 8 years, there's something they weren't looking out for that was an obvious... It's like silly putty, you step on one end of silly putty, it pops out the other end. If you're going to regulate...
Can we stop? Can I ask you to stop doing something?
What, trying to be nice to people?
Trying to make excuses for felons.
I'm not making excuses. I'm talking about the Fed.
Because all of these things, I mean, this is like this stuff, you know, that has come out of this this database that was really this Medicaid stuff, right?
Yeah.
That, I mean, seriously, there's, I have someone on my system. I showed him how to set up the, you know, because if I just tell you something, if you can't replicate it, right, by the way, this is what science is supposed to be, right? Is I announced that I found something. Okay, that's nice. Now, in order for that to actually have any validity at all, you need to be able to take my experimental conditions and get the same results. If you can't get the same results, then either I'm wrong or I'm lying. Those are the two possibilities,
right?
Okay? Being wrong is part of how we figure things out. Lying is always has a motive. All right. Right, now, it may just be that I don't want to admit that I'm stupid.
Okay, but the split here, and I know you're always...
All right, now wait a minute. Here's where I'm going with this. So this guy, one of the guys on my system, got his hands on a pretty modest computer by today's standards, okay? Less powerful than the one that I ran this analysis on. On his desk, gets his hands on it, loads up the same database software that I use, puts that data in there, grabs the second table, which basically allows you to put names to provider numbers, puts those two in there, and in a join on those two with a sort takes him 17 seconds for his computer to execute.
Really?
17 seconds. Okay? Now, he and I have quite small resources compared to our government, right? Very small.
Well, that's what I'm trying to delineate. You always zero in, and rightly so,
Chief,
so by the way.
Here's the point.
All right.
If I can identify that it is almost certain that this is fraud in 17 seconds, and so can another person who replicates the results, then you cannot tell me that the people within the government didn't know.
Well, that's, as they used to say on the trading floor, there's three kinds of people in the world. One kind makes things happen, one kind watches what happens, the other people wonder what happened. And I don't really want, in other words, Kevin, referee this. Carl, I understand where you're coming from. The people who do this are the fraudsters. But we also have people we pay to just kind of watch what's going on.
I
don't know the question whether they're in on the fraud or they're just clueless. I don't know.
They're in on the fraud,
okay.
All of them, at the federal and state levels, because every dollar that you manage to steal, regardless of the mechanism, goes to GDP, drops to the bottom line, and both the federal and the state governments want to see that, because the person who steals it then goes out to Cheddar's and has dinner.
Well, it's... I mean, Kevin, you and I went through this.
Well, we got to work on their taste.
Yeah,
the check is bad, but it's.
Well,
like,
I'm just saying.
But if I'm raking it in, I'm going someplace better than that. But that, you know, same thing. CBS News is reporting this week on hospice fraud, and they focused in on California where it's acute, but they're also saying it's nationwide, which of course
it is.
And in their case, they opened with the story of a 69-year-old woman, that they say is a pickleball whiz. And she injured herself playing. Medicare wouldn't pay for her treatment. Why? Because she's dying and in hospice. Do I look like I'm dying?
But
what they've done is, just by running the data, exactly what Carl just described, just by taking some raw data that's publicly available and running the data, all of a sudden you see all of these suspects in here. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, when we have people charged with oversight, it's one thing to say, well, I'm oversighting, I'm knocking on doors, I'm auditing company books. They're not, but they're doing it sort of randomly and not catching things. There's all kinds of ways that they do it, but the data is so available. This was the same thing that, you know, with the Doge Group. They just started running data and started finding places to look. This is not new technology. This isn't something that's just all of a sudden available. It's been there forever, for a really, really long time. And the problem is that people either don't want to know, or they're just willfully ignoring data that they see. And so when we get back to exactly what Carl just said, is they're part of the fraud. They need, you know, the people charged with oversight are just as guilty as the people committing the fraud. And so I want to throw the people committing the frauds in jail. I want to throw the people charged with oversight in jail as well.
I take my example earlier, because I was going to go into the math on credit default swaps, but I don't think the world's ready for that this morning.
Yeah, please don't do that to me. I got it, you know, 2:30 in the morning. So.
Let's go back to the mortgage situation and the auditors and the stuff you were talking about, Kevin. All of a sudden, suppose I am the head of the Fed and you guys are on the board with me. Boy, every meeting would be interesting, wouldn't it? And all of a sudden we notice, it sure seems like a lot of dudes are borrowing money in Japan and coming over here and buying mortgages. And it keeps going up, and it keeps going up. Well, there's no law against it. There's nothing that says that we can't go over to Japan, borrow money at, well, they're up to 2.5%, but even so, it's lower than here. There's no law that says we can't go over, borrow, you know, $1 million worth of yen, turn it into dollars, and come on over here and buy something. There's no law against that. But now
it's not illegal, right?
And now, if it's next month, it's $4 million, and next month it's $20 million, and somebody's going to say, okay, where the hell is it going? Gee, it looks like people are buying these mortgages, and you go, well, that's interesting. Do any of them have the forward contract on the yen? I mean, these are the questions that I would ask, and so would you guys. But where does the guy noticing it at the Fed, when is he, A, what can he do about it, and B, how did it become fraud on his part? I guess at some point, if it really starts to take the system down, but on day one or day 20 or...
Wait a minute. BS. It's fraud on the first day, and the reason it's fraud on the first day, with the explicit complicity and involvement of the Fed, is that all of this is supposed to go against your reserves.
Reserves?
Your loan loss reserves.
Your loan loss reserves. All of this has to have a capital backing somewhere. So where is it?
I'm saying we're the ones who did it. We bought it and brought the money over.
I'm just saying, excuse me, if you buy something that has a non-tangible value, right? All right? I mean, if it other than currency, all right, whether it's stock or whatever have you, its value is not fixed. The value at risk is where the issue is. That's what we're really talking about here, isn't it?
What I'm saying is there's a trend here that if it reaches a point, it becomes ominous. But nothing in the trend. We could go tomorrow and borrow money at Japan, the three of us. Well, I don't think they'll let us $20 million, but
well,
they might.
I don't know if they'd give us that.
Well, say they gave us $100,000, and we came back here and put it in a bank, and we bought God knows what, you know, XYZ that we think is going to go to the moon, and it does. And Every brokerage firm is going to take that check from a bank. Why wouldn't they? It's good cash.
Oh, okay. And Chief, as you know, because you do this, okay, if I come to you and I hand you a check for $1 million, okay, well, I wire you $1 million, and
a guy like you'd bring the cash probably.
Well, yeah, it'd be a suitcase full of hundreds, yeah. Right? And then I'd get a SAR report filed.
We'd end up saying sorry, Charlie, like the tuna.
Yeah, get out. But yeah, so the thing is, though, is that you've got so that happens. All right, now I can buy more than $1 million worth of securities.
$2 million,
cash.
Yeah, you buy $2 million.
I can buy $2 million, right? However, your, well, through the people that actually clear it, everything else, there's a chain on that if the value starts to go down.
Yeah, but the beauty is you're borrowing at 2% instead of what our clearing firm charges you.
Well, I get that, yeah. but the point being that if the value starts to go down, it isn't all that long before my phone rings.
Okay? Well, I guess the part we're dancing around here, and Kevin is acting as our referee. When does it become somebody's job to look at all the subprime? We know the subprime is shifting away from the banks because of Dodd-Frank and all the other stuff. They want to look pristine white when they're not. Right, I'm with you on that. So all of a sudden, now if everybody goes out and raises their own capital to run, you know, Chief Carl and Kevin's subprime loan place, I guess it's not our problem too much. But if all of a sudden the banks just, instead of lending it to the subprime guy, just lend it to this guy to lend to the subprime guy, at some point it becomes a problem. Where does it become illegal, I guess is my question. Where does it become someplace we need to look at it now? Because somebody else...
It becomes illegal when you... this is the same thing. All right, so we already have structuring laws. They already exist. It is already a felony to violate them. All right? If you set up an organized set of transactions with the intent of evading the surveillance that normally takes place, it is a crime. It is a felony offense, and you are supposed to go to prison.
Well, but if the place is 80% capital and a bank loans them the other 20%, that happens all the time. Where's the number? Where's the number that it's a fraud?
When I structure the transactions to evade the oversight.
Okay, I get it.
That's where it becomes a criminal offense.
Some of these companies are pretty household words. I don't know that people would loan to them.
I didn't say people would loan to them. All right, that's not the point. The point is, if I structure the transactions as one of these firms. Now, see, you know where the real problem. I'll tell you where the real problem is that after, all right, so remember when the 2000 blow-up happened, okay, there were a handful of executives that actually did get charged criminally.
Yep.
All right, and a couple of them died before they could go to jail, so technically they were considered not felons because there's this quirk in the law that says that if you die before you actually report to prison, it doesn't count, which is, I guess...
That's what happened to...
Well, I guess that's just about your legacy.
No,
right?
No. That's what happened to Enron.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ken Lay.
Ken Lay. He died before he went to jail.
I got to ask you, is he really dead?
Well, I don't know, but, you know, I guess that's a fair question. So, you know, but I mean, yeah, there's a whole set of really kind of bizarre laws.
Just to fill people in, he was convicted, he filed an appeal... And allegedly had a heart attack, and so the whole conviction went away, right?
The way the law is structured is that if you croak before you report, it is considered to not count.
Well, even in an appeal, you consider to have won the appeal, right?
Well, it's not a final. It's not final because it's the appeal's still pending, right?
What did George Bush refer to him as? Kenny Boy, he's one of his best buddies, right?
You know, hey, funny how all those things happen, right?
This is all tied together.
You know what the thing is? He's dead, so there you go, right?
We think.
Well, I mean, assuming he's really dead, he lost anyway, right? Because he's dead.
Maybe they'll find him out on an Epstein's New Mexico place they're searching.
You know, all kinds of interesting things could happen, right? you're right, it could happen.
What do you do? I'll keep this brief, but when you went back to the... credit default swaps. Now here's a, and I'm gonna. Sometime,
you've been dying.
What I wanted to do on this one, Kevin, is this is kind of an audit question as well. I mean, if you come in and audit, if you unless you're, what's his name, the guy who died in jail, the biggest Ponzi scheme ever. What was his name? Bernie Madoff.
Unless you're
Bernie Madoff, and you can come up with your own clearing firm, it's pretty hard for PTI to screw somebody when all the paperwork's coming out of RBC or IB, and your stock gets marked to market every night. I mean, you couldn't screw somebody if you wanted to, which is a good thing. But with the credit default swaps, and this is the part, Kevin, when I get into the audit piece, is what these guys were doing. I mean, the theory of it is, if I loan money to Italy, say, and the going rate's 8% versus loaning it in the U.S. where it's 3%, the other 5% is considered risk premium, right? And it's probably there for a reason. You know, Italy's got a much greater chance of going under than the U.S., of course. I don't know about that today, but the traditionally they did because they have a couple times. And so what a bank would do is say, okay, get your money at lend the money to Cyprus or Italy or whatever damn place. We'll sell you insurance on the loan. Well, the insurance should be the same 5%, right? So there should be no money to be made there. But yeah, evidently there is. They're lending you the money at, say, a 3% number, less than the difference in the rate, and they're essentially taking the other 2% risk on Italy or Cyprus, which... But the weird part was, this happened with the guy Merrill Lynch, but he left... Well, there's a guy that should have been prosecuted, Carl. He left. What they were doing is saying, oh, no, we sold this at 3%. Our algorithms, now we're not marked to market by a third party, our algorithm said it should be 2%, your own algorithm, which is interesting. We just made 1%. Duh. And we're going to pay a bonus based on the 1%. This 3%, instead of waiting to see whether this loan actually makes it or Italy makes it to 30 years, we're going to take 1% to profit, and I'm going to pay my ass a nice big bonus. That's something. Kevin, what would an auditor say to that? Somehow they got away with it for years. How do you do that?
Yeah, and what I'll say is, you know, again, going back to the notion of, you know, using the data, this is where we break down. Auditors can go in, they can pore over all the books, they can, you know, they can say, oh, this loan needs to be marked with a higher risk rating. They can do all of that kind of stuff, and that's all fine, you know, but we have the tools to do better than that. We have the tools to, you know, just to look into all kinds of fraudulent activities like that, and we don't use them. We don't use them either because it's the government and that, you know, government oversight, and they're just too damn behind the times, and that happens a lot in government, as far as I can tell. So they're too far behind to be able to implement anything so sophisticated as that, and it's not that sophisticated. But more to the point is, and I'll go back to it, we don't want to know.
Well, that's
you know, that's the reason you wouldn't use the tools available, is because you don't want to know. And if you don't want to know, you don't want to ask the questions, you don't want to upset the apple cart, you're just as much part of the fraud as anybody else. And that's the most benign take I can have.
Well, you do realize, Ren, we're coming at this in three, the same objective. You're saying that the tools are there and people are too lazy or too clueless or don't want to use them. I'm saying maybe the people we put in charge just aren't inquisitive enough, that they're too much Sergeant Schultz in them. And Carl says that they're all involved in the scam, so they don't want to look because they're getting somehow paid off. Either well, all these three are
quite as I think stupidity is. Actually, Sergeant Schultz I don't want to know. His wasn't a competence issue. He just, you know, said, you know, I see nothing, hear nothing. Yeah. I did not even get up today. So, you know, that's our guy Schultz. But yeah, I don't think. I don't think the people who are guiding oversight are that stupid across the board. I think there's a lot of really stupid people that find their way up, up various organizational ladders. But I don't think they're that stupid.
Well, how much of it, Kevin, do you think, and this is, you know, across both aisles, how much of it is that if you're president, and we've been around for a bunch of them, are we really going to put a guy in the Comptroller of the Currency or the Fed or wherever, FDIC, that the first day he's going to come flying out of there like Bobby Kennedy going after stuff he went after, when those are the people that gave you all the money to put you in office? I mean, have we reached, is that part of the game here? I think it probably is. I don't know how much.
Well, Chief, let's just point out the utter insanity of this. In that, who was in charge of the New York Fed desk at the time of the blow-up in 07?
Was what's his name? Gorsuch, the guy?
Guy?
Yeah, the guy wrote the book.
Right. Guess what happened to him?
Get promoted.
He became Treasury Secretary.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he had, as the person at the, with his finger on, at the New York Fed desk, okay, as it was later disclosed when the Veloukis report came out with regards to Lehman, the forensic analysis of what happened at Lehman, all right, the New York Fed factually knew approximately a month before they blew up that they were bankrupt. And the reason they knew is because Lehman Brothers attempted to do a tri-party repo with Citibank. Now, who holds the collateral in a tri-party repo? The New York Fed.
Yeah.
Okay. They attempted to do a tri-party repo. They presented the collateral to Citibank. Citibank took a look at it and said, that's trash. What else do you have? And the answer was nothing.
Well, 6 months to a year before this all happened, one of our clients got skunked in one of Bear Stearns off-balance sheet investment things, and
yeah.
I never put two and two together that the Bear Stearns was going under. I wish I would have.
Well, but here's the thing. They, at that instant in time, they factually, the New York Fed desk factually knew Lehman was broke because the tri-party repo was rejected.
Well, we don't,
and yet,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And yet, not only did they, and, oh, by the way, Citibank knew too. Now, isn't that interesting? Because what do you think their trading desk was doing the day after that?
Now, who is?
Because there was an awful lot of short interest in Lehman when it blew up, wasn't there?
Who's Kevin? Don't be a wise guy here. Who's Geithner's dad? Don't say Mr. Geithner. I mean, he was some huge big shot, double something there. But he, I read part of his book, and it had to do with every, if he was like a bleep up in college, the old man would get him a job as like a page in Congress or something to show him the right way. Or, I mean, instead of, you know, smack him upside the head and make him work construction for the summer, he'd get him some huge job in Washington that like nobody else could get just to show them the right way.
How, yeah, that'll shape them up.
Yeah, that,
yeah. I'm like, yeah, that'll solve all your problems, yeah. Right?
I'm surprised Kevin didn't come back with the Mr. Geithner, who is his dad. The
he might have been Dr. Geithner, so you know, you gotta,
he could have been. Yeah, he could have been. But the I mean, you all this stuff. That's why listening to Wayne is so fascinating. How all these people are tied together and they never leave. How did? You know, one thing, I hope he finds it. How did
that's the club, Tom. That's, you know, that's why, you know, that's why getting into an Ivy League school isn't for the great education that you get that's so much better than the education you get everywhere else. It's getting membership in the club, and once you're in, you know, then you're connected. You're pretty much set. Even if you're just the biggest nitwit on the face of the earth, you still have a lot of places where they'll just hire you. They'll give you something to do.
I was on a trading floor. There was I was in the OEX, but of course you hear everything, right? Talk about no secrets. There was a guy, I think, in the telephone pit. It might have been IBM, but I think it was telephone. His dad went to one of those. I didn't even know what a boarding school was until I got in the floor. Yeah, what's a boarding school? They go, we go away to high school. I said, you go away to high school? Why would anybody do that? That's how naive I was. Anyway, they went to boarding school together. So whenever the earnings were coming out, the guy'd call his kid's old man and tell him what the earnings were. Of course, earnings are really tough to trade. I think the kid lost money like 7 to 10 times, so I wasn't too worried about it. But I mean, earnings are very tough to trade, especially when you don't know what the announcement's going to be afterward. But if you just know the earnings ahead of something, I don't know if you make money on that. That's not something I would. Now, a Fed announcement, yeah. Labor announcement, not so much. So I mean, some of this information is really important. Some seems like it's already front run, if you know what I mean.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, because I mean, Kevin, if all of a sudden now there is some big hole in this subprime, I guess my point is, when did somebody know about it? Is there anything anybody could have done about it? Is it the fact that the economy itself is not doing near as well as people think it is? Why are these people all going under if they are? I mean, there's a, what we did this morning is we, in my mind, we just came up with about 15 other questions, right?
Well, yeah, you kind of did, right? I mean, that's essentially the, you know, the essence of all of that. I think my, you know, my take on this is that we are, as is always the case, the reason that we have these busts when things go kaboom boom is because there's people that have their hands in the cookie jar, and theft becomes a ever larger part of the whole. And what we have found with this Medicaid data release in particular, if you extrapolate this out just in CMS by itself, and then you take that and look at that across the entire federal budget, essentially all of the inflationary pressure that the American consumer has taken over the last 25 years has been stolen. It's not because the federal government expanded programs that actually benefited people. It's because it was robbed.
Well, it gets taken along the way.
No. Careful here, Chief. Come on. You understand compound math.
Yeah. When you start stealing, I'll tell you how much I understand compound math. When we first started PTI, early 90s, 91, but we, you know, started to branch out and get a lot better by 93, 94. Well, Audrey, she still was her Series 7. She was working down here before she went back to real estate more full time. She was trying to open doors down here for us to manage money. You know, we're good at it. You know, we're young. You know, I mean, I had nice resume, all this kind of stuff. I'm on the board of the SIBO. So Audrey's opening up doors. Matter of fact, she walked in the St. Patrick's Day parade that year with the people who ran the pensions of the Chicago Police Department. And, you know, good guys. And she says, well, can you give us any money to manage? Oh, no, you guys aren't connected enough. I mean, so that was the answer to that, right? But the weird part was I was trying to sell them, say, you know, instead of paying a consultant to hire Big Cap Bob, Mid Cap Mike, and all these people, paying them 1%, and oh, by the way, paying the consultants, and oh, by the way, they're doing all this trading, they're going to go through, half of them are going to go through a minority firm where they're paying 3 cents a share instead of one. The grift on this thing is dramatic. And at the time, from what I recall, they were like 92% of what they needed in the pension fund. And so I'm sitting there, I said, my presentation I gave to Audrey, and Audrey's good at this, she says, you know, we'll do this. We will index this stuff, which Northwestern had just done. We'll put you in the spiders and the queues. We're not going to try and trade all day long. If you want protection, we'll do that. If not, we'll just keep you balanced. I mean, if you want, maybe we'll overweight 1 year the energy sector. Instead of being 5%, we'll be 8% something. But we're going to stick with indexes. We're not paying the fees. You don't have to pay anybody 1% a year. And by the way, we'll do the whole mess for like, 0.2% or something. They had zero interest. All of a sudden, fast forward 20 years, and now they're like, 40% of what they needed. Right. If you multiply the 20 years times the 2%, 2.25% fees they were paying, where are you? Down 50%.
About there. Right.
So, I mean, this is not. This math is pretty easy to do, really. Right? But anyway, this one before we let Kevin wants a dash or whatever, you're always talking about the medical part of this, Carl, and we just had the inflation report. We're having the PCE today, which is, since we don't have any detail, you can't yuck about that one too much. But I went back. Actually, I don't know if they always did this, but you can actually Google one line of the CPI, and it'll give you the history of that one line. Which I don't know if the Bureau of Labor Statistics always did that, but now lately I've been using it. It's pretty fascinating. So I said, medical service CPI historical. And it blows you all the way back to like 1960 or something. So I went back to 2000. And now we always are talking about in the basket, and even like Larissa and people who say the numbers are good, in the basket, the medical services are 6.5% of your basket. When it's 21% of the economy, and I know people where it's 40% of their basket, right, that are on fixed income. But anyway, I went back and just looked at that line, and these are their numbers. According to their numbers, that line would be 240% of it's gone up since 2000. And I'm going to guess the three of us are going to say, well, that's bullshit. It's more like 3.5 or 4. But let's leave it at 2.40. The full CPI is 1.8. So they're saying something cost $1 in 2000 costs you $1.80 today. Again, a number we might argue with. But let's just stick with their stuff. If you take the difference between the 6.5% and the 21%, which is part of the economy, that now adds 48 cents to the 1.8, which brings that number up to 2.4. So things are 2.2, 220% higher than they were. If you go back to what that is per year and you look at the growth rate, you can say we've been in a recession since 2000.
Yeah.
I mean that's pretty simple math, but you guys know where I'm coming from. And it's right there.
Well, it's just and the point that I've gotten into it with people before, they say, well, Clinton balanced the budget. No, he didn't. No, he did not.
Came a lot closer than everybody else, but
he did not. Okay, how do I know this? Well, because the amount of debt that the federal government had each year went up.
There were a couple of years where it actually went down.
No, it did not. Stop that. Go back to debt to the penny. Go back in those tables and actually pull the debt to the penny numbers. No, it didn't. What he did was he did something that then every president after him did, just like when Carter and Nixon rejiggered some of the CPI stuff Carter did. Once somebody starts it, it never ends. What he did was steal the Social Security surplus and spend it.
Right.
Okay.
Well, actually, I think Johnson started that, but it's been done, yeah.
But Clinton was the one that made an art form out of it, okay? And that was his change within the way that the accounting was done within the executive.
Well, he also had the benefit of the tax code during the dot-bomb era. If somebody made $1 gazillion, they had to pay taxes. If somebody lost $1 gazillion, they could only deduct $3,000 a year. So
they could only take $3,000 a year. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and by the way, that one's still there today.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
It's the same number. When I got in the business, we're talking about if you have a capital loss, you can only deduct $3,000 against your regular income. That number was $3,000 when I broke into the business, and the Dow was 800, and now the Dow is, 40,000 or something? And it's still 3,000.
Yeah.
And nobody ever mentions it at any TV show, radio show, whatever, except us.
Well, of course not, because if you actually and we don't teach kids this in school either, because if we ever did, young and full of there might be a revolution by morning. So, that risk is unacceptable. We can't be doing that.
All right, we still have Kevin. I got to give him the list here. Major league teams, Kevin. Who's the most valuable?
Dodgers.
Yankees, $9 billion, Dodgers, $8 billion, Cubs, 5.2, Boston Red Sox, $5 billion, Giants, $3.8 billion.
Cubs, 5.2, you're joking.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I don't agree, I'm just reading it off.
That one surprises me.
It's up. They're up 13% from a year ago.
Yeah, surprises you for that it should be higher or should be lower?
Well, there's a reason I call them the flubs, but
do you have any idea how good Marquis? I thought Marquis was a clunk.
That's one thing, but I will tell you, having just been
they're obviously filling stadiums, right? I mean
filling stadiums, own their own broadcast network.
Yeah,
but I was also in Arizona. Most of the week until yesterday evening, and went to a Cubs spring training game as well as a White Sox spring training game, and I will tell you that the Cubs have built this whole, God, I hate to use the term brand because it's such an overused such a trite term, but it does apply here. They have built the Wrigley Field, the Wrigley Cubs experience, the Wrigley neighborhood experience,
yeah,
replicated that to through their spring training site, and it's the, you know, so it's the same thing, and it's jammed. It's full of people. The Cubs are, you know, are a revenue machine, and the, you know, the only difference between the Cubs and a lot of those other higher you know, higher value teams is that the Cubs don't plow as much back into their on-field payroll as the other teams, and they don't have a trivial payroll, but when you look at percentage of revenue to percentage to the payroll as a percentage of revenue, they are lower than teams like the Dodgers and the Yankees.
Kevin, if I could ask you, are you surprised, just to give a brief history of the Cubs and how they became America's team, is the Cubs, when I was very young, Cubs hit home games ran and the Sox home games ran, and Jack Brickhouse did both of them. So I come home from school, and if I turn a ball game on, I'd watch the last couple innings, I'd watch the Cubs 1 week and the Sox the next week. Well, then the Cubs decided they were going to go, or the WGN decided they were going to take one team and do all their games, road and home, and they picked the Cubs. Probably the only reason was that the WGN studios was on the north side, not the south side. Other than that, I can't think of any reason why.
It was up the road. It was just up Madison.
Both teams drew almost exactly 1 million people. There was no real difference in the Sox had more night games, the Cubs had more day games, so they picked the Cubs. Now this is before satellite, and one of these days we have some time, Carl can rattle us down. They actually used to go over telephone lines for video. I can't imagine how much they paid for that, phone you paid in those days. But so they were. I mean, if you were in Oklahoma having a beer at lunch, you're watching the Cub game. They absolutely became America's team because they were on during the day everywhere. Yeah. And Ted Turner tried to do the same thing with the Braves, but he was a little too late. But now the Cubs have
pretty successful with it for quite a while. But yeah, they were. It was the superstation concept.
But are you surprised, Kevin, that now that they're just like any other team, and everybody is, they're going to be on major. WGN isn't. Well, they don't. WGN doesn't even do them anymore. Now they're on. They're no different. They're on Marquee, just like the Dodgers are on their people out there, or the Sox are on Sports Channel. Are you surprised that they've managed to hold on to this culture? I am. I thought they would have lost that. Now they're just another team, and they're not on nationwide.
Well, and I'll give them credit to that for that they have done it. They're, I mean, the marketing angle, the marketing operation of the Cubs is really, really good. It's way better than their historical performance. Although, they have a pretty good team.
Right, who's
you can't. I mean, you can't. You can't argue with results. It is what it is.
Well, it's also a small stadium in a metropolitan area of 6.5 million people.
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah.
What have they done with it now? You know, they've completely bought up the neighborhood, all those rooftop buildings, and then they across the street from them. They have built out the Wrigley Field area, the whole Lakeview area there. They've built that out as the Cubs Entertainment District, and so they've created a whole experience around being part of the Cubs, around being a Cubs fan, and they've sold it really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's got to reach all, certainly throughout the Midwest. The buses, the busloads of people keep coming in from, Iowa, from Wisconsin, from places like that. And, everybody is going to make at least their annual trip to the Shrine. And, it's a pain in the ass to get to a game. But
when Cleveland built the new stadium, we were in talks with a guy out there at a brokerage firm, and he almost joined PTI, one of the nicest guys ever walked, but he had this serious diabetes problem that I think might have nailed him in the end. But these guys in Cleveland, no matter where you worked, you could work in a gas station. On the day of a home game, you got to wear a Cleveland jersey. When that new stadium came out, and they got away from the one on the lake that had, was a lot bigger and everything, you could not get a ticket. These guys were part of a group that had stadium club stuff. They would switch off every day. One of the secretaries, they had secretaries in those days, would call in at exactly 5 o'clock to reserve the table. Just the the stadium is the mirror image of Sox Park. Instead of the stadium club being on a right field side, it's on a left field side. So there's one table at the very bottom that's really closest to the field. They would get that table every night. And we had dinner there, and that's where we watched the game. It was terrific. But every seat was taken. And all of a sudden, one year it wasn't. The next year it was less. And it just faded away. And now I have the Cleveland Indians as the 25th most valuable team with a new with a relatively new stadium. I won't say new anymore, but pretty nice.
It's got to be at least...
Well, it's probably 20 years old.
It's more than 20.
But I'm saying it hasn't aged. It's still nice. They're only 1.6 billion. Their revenue is 339, and their earnings are 37, according to these guys. All right, guess who's the least valued team? You'll probably get this. Actually, you might not, but because I'm not sure if they own the stadium or not. Maybe they don't. Tampa Bay.
Guess it's the Athletics, but I can't swear to that.
No, it's Tampa Bay, huh? Okay.
No, I'm sorry. Miami Marlins.
Oh, okay.
And they've got the new stadium, and the mayor got run out of... I have a client from down there, and he goes, you know, the mayor got tossed out of office because he spent so much money on a stadium, right, and people are all pissed off. I said, it doesn't matter. He's still in a skybox every night. He's still a guy you have to be with. He's like the Epstein. I'm not saying he's a sex offender. But even though he went out of there in disgrace because of all these people who got money making the stadium, he's still a guy you have to know. The bottom fishers are Miami, Kansas City, the Pirates, Minnesota Twins. I guess I'm surprised there. Cincinnati Reds, they got a beautiful place. Cleveland, Tampa Bay, the Rockies. Rockies, I'm kind of surprised, are 23. They're pretty full all the time. The Brewers are 22, your team, Kevin. Then you get in the middle. They got the White Sox is 17th. The White Sox are, what do they have their valuation as? The valuation is 2.5. They lost $54 million last year. Their revenue was only 224. There's nobody in that park.
Well.
I mean,
how much you want to bet they had a positive cash flow anyway?
I wonder. Boy, they don't pay hardly anything in rent. Matter of fact, they don't draw a million people. They don't pay any rent, but I think they did draw a million people. So they're not paying much rent, but still, I don't think they're doing so well. The Skybox, I don't think, are half frozen. Anyway, they got the Yankees at, let me see how much the Yankees make, according to these guys. How do you get these numbers out of these closely held corporations?
And that gets to be the thing, is what's on their books, what's off their books, and so on. Because they, you know, I don't know how they all handle licensing, and I'm sure whoever is doing who's the article who published the article.
This is CNBC by they've been doing this. Remember we did the NBA a few weeks ago, Kevin, and we did a football. Whoever does this kind of routinely.
So they can probably dig into the broadcast properties that are separate entities.
Michael Ozanian.
Into how licensing is handled for a lot of stuff. Some of the licensing goes through MLB. Some of the licensing doesn't. There's different pieces to the whole thing, and that's why I was just sort of, you know, when you start to look at them, you have to look at the whole, and just walking around Chicago, how much Cubs stuff do you see versus how much White Sox stuff do you see?
Now, do they share all that like football?
What, all their licensing revenue?
Yeah.
I am sure that there is some stuff that's done through MLB and some stuff that is left to the teams, and it just sort of depends on what you're talking about.
Well, football years ago used to be...
If it's teamware and it's shared, and I don't know this for sure, I'm just speculating here, so don't take this as gospel, but if it's teamware, that would be the kind of thing, you know, team logo stuff that would be shared. But if it then is stuff about Wrigley Field stuff, all of that kind of crap, that would not be shared.
Well, the interesting thing here is that they got the Yankees only making $8 million.
Yeah, I'm sure. Then how much did the Yankees network make?
Well, but how much did the executives get paid?
Well, that too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's a. I mean, way back in the day, the NFL, all the official jersey sales, it was like $3 million a team. I'm talking like the '80s, and the funny part, there was a couple of years that the hottest selling jersey was. You'll never guess. It was the Dolphins because it was a gang sign. Those are gang colors.
Oh,
And of course, they had no idea. They got the Dodgers making $92 million. The revenue is $950. Wow.
Well, and look at their payroll.
Yeah, but is it more than the Yankees?
Oh God, yeah.
Oh, it is.
I mean, hell, they just went and signed up Kyle Tucker. You know, to an incredible deal. You know, and that's a team that already has Ohtani, although he's got a team friendly structure to his contract. But they got Ohtani, they got Mookie Betts, they got Will Smith. I mean, you start ticking down the line of the big contracts they have. It's so far above and beyond all the other payrolls in Major League Baseball, and everybody bitches about it. But hey, you know what? You know they're not breaking any rules.
Well, they got to pay a tax, right?
Yeah, they got to pay a luxury tax, and you know that's one of those things that every time they negotiate it, you have all of the richest teams are sitting there going, oh no, don't raise the luxury tax, and then after they pass the increase in the luxury tax, then everybody gets together at the bar. All the rich teams get together at the bar and say, look, they only charged us that much.
Well, the Yankees have $755 in revenue, $5 million in income. The Dodgers have, where are we here? They're 900, whatever, the revenue is $200 million more than the Yankees? I would not have guessed that. And their earnings are $92 million. I thought the Dodgers had all kinds of problems getting their, you know what though, Kevin, I think they got to keep.
Right, not all that crap. That was also tied up in divorce proceedings and things like that. And
didn't they
all got sorted out several years ago now.
Yeah, because they, for a while, they got to keep all of their capital revenue, right? Because the Major League Baseball, kind of a quick story here, and I'm not an attorney, but pile in, Carl, if you want to. But the owners were having a divorce fight, and the idea that the team, the direction of where the team was heading, would get into a divorce court, essentially get away from Major League Baseball controlling it, was like sticking everybody where the sun don't shine in Major League Baseball. So they essentially allowed these people bought the Dodgers for some huge amount of money. In the matter of fact, 2012, they paid $2 billion, which was an incredible amount of money in 2012. And I think to make the money up, Kevin, they got to keep all the cable revenue for like 3 or 5 years or something. With some deal where the other team said rather than essentially have the divorce court have any say who the owners are, we're willing to take a hit. Is that the way that went? I'm pretty sure that's the way it went.
Well, I don't remember at all, Tom.
Well, I don't know what makes you remember something like that. You know what? I think Lou gave me that story. That's where I remember it. Anyway, but anyway, these are the valuations, and the guy who wrote it is a good Armenian lad, Michael Ozanian. So I assume he has some pretty good sources, but I don't know, I guess. Well, let's check one more and see what the Cubs' revenue is. I don't think it's 950. But I bet it's pretty good. Cubs are, according to this, they are 552. So they're 400 million below the Dodgers. They're 200 million below the Yankees, but they claim they're making 74 million. All right. So if you're making 74 million, and we won't do this today, but they say the value is 8 billion. Their view of the future is pretty darn rosy, don't you think? Because $74 million, see, $8 billion, and it's if you're borrowing at 6%, you got to write a what do you got to pay? $48 million check every year, right? No, $480 million check every year, and you're only making 74. I'm not so sure. I want to borrow the money and pay $8 billion for this team. Do you? Unless you think 10 years from now, the ticket price would be like $1,000 or something.
Well, unless there's just a whole lot of other revenue that's not included in it.
I don't know. Does anybody watch the marquee when the Cubs aren't playing? They don't have anybody else on that channel.
No, but they'll do some, you know, they'll pick up some syndicated college basketball and some of that kind of stuff. But generally, no. But the stuff that they show is their own productions, and the production cost of it and the broadcast cost of it is dirt cheap.
Yeah, but how many times can you watch games from 1980?
Well, it's partly that. It's partly profiles of of Cubs, Cubs stars past and present. They do a lot of that stuff. I never watch it. I'm not a consumer of that, so it doesn't interest me. But on the other hand, it's filling up the time on there and costs them virtually nothing. So, they're just keeping the broadcast day moving as they go, and then they have the regular programming.
Well, how many games you go see?
Has some stuff with the Bears too, some like Bears post games or that kind of thing.
How many games did you see?
Oh, two. I saw the Cubs play and saw Matt Shaw play right field and make a really nice catch running over by the wall into foul territory. So the guy looks like he has a chance to be able to learn the position. And then I saw the White Sox play. The White Sox experience was more like what I want spring training to be. So the Cubs, I saw it. I got a load of what their spring training experience is going to be next time I go down there. And for the listeners who don't know, my son and daughter-in-law live down there, so I try to get down there, at least once a year, and usually I would go. I've been there for spring training before, but normally I would go for December, late December, early January, that kind of thing. I wasn't able to travel this year at that point in time. So,
well, you can now.
Anyway, the White Sox was more the spring training experience where you go, you kick back. The stadium's not that crowded. You kick back, you enjoy a ball game on a beautiful afternoon. The pace is a lot slower. And I'm hanging out with my daughter and my son, and we're just shooting the breeze about all kinds of things while enjoying a baseball game. That to me is what spring training should be.
Well, the last couple times I went down there, I would only go see the Cubs in away games.
Yeah, I could see that, and I think they're playing at the White Sox today. So, that would be a good one. But again. When I went Sunday to see the Cubs, first of all, it was Sunday, which is going to be more crowded anyway. But it was very crowded, and it was a really hot day, so that also factored in. Needed to get into the shade a few times, but for the White Sox game, it was just a nice even pace type of thing. The White Sox beat the crap out of the.
For those who have never done it, to pile out of a Chicago winter, show up in shorts and a short sleeve shirt. In that sun for 4 hours, good luck. you're gonna have a rough night if you didn't put a whole bunch of stuff on.
Sunblock for sure. Sunblock was part of the equation.
All right, Kevin, we'll have a good one, and we'll talk. You might have to. Mr. Flanagan will not be here on Monday, so I might have to tap you. We'll tap or a couple people. Who knows? We'll be talking about. By the way, I don't understand this line. Pete Hegseth on Straight Ahead Moves. He's been. Don't need to worry about it. Okay then. That's why we're allowing Russians to sell oil to people?
Well, so here's the thing about this whole little excursion, right? I don't know. I mean, war is probably the technically correct term. Blowing people up on a mass basis is usually considered war. But so many people have said, there's been 100 excuses put out there about precisely why, all right? And I ripped through one of the ones that I have heard. I've heard this one literally my entire adult life. They're going to get a nuclear bomb if we do not do whatever, okay? In this case, blow them all to hell.
Yep.
All right. For those of you who don't read my column, but do listen to the show, I want to point out a very simple fact, and that is that in the history of the use of nuclear weapons, which, by the way, there have been two, right, that have been used in anger, right? We used both of them. Only one was a uranium-based weapon, the one we dropped on Hiroshima. The next one that we dropped on Nagasaki was a plutonium-based weapon. And all of the current stuff in people's inventory is plutonium-based. All of it. Now, there is a very good physics-based reason for this. And it is simply that uranium has a very small amount of fissile material in the ore that comes out of the ground. And because all of the isotopes of an element are physically identical from a chemical perspective, the only way that you can separate them is by weight, which means you have to turn it into a gas and put it in a centrifuge, which is what all this stuff about blowing up.
That's why it took how many thousand tons of stuff before World War II, before we make one bomb?
Well, that's right. Okay, so, but here's the problem. If you want to make a bomb, the way you make a bomb is you take something that is fissile and you assemble, usually using explosives because it has to happen very, 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 very fast, you assemble something that does not have a critical mass into something that does. All right? So in the case of the Hiroshima bomb, you took two pieces of highly enriched uranium, uranium-235, that were not critical. You put them at opposite ends of a pipe, you put explosives on there, and you drive them together at very high speed. They come together, they form a critical mass, and it goes kaboom. The problem with this is, in order to the yield of that device, for that device to explode, it has to be very pure. And if it's not, it either doesn't explode at all, or it's kind of like a little firecracker instead of a big kaboom. All right. So it is a five-alarm pain in the butt, first off. And secondly, it's not the efficient way to make a nuclear bomb. So the efficient way to make a nuclear bomb is you use plutonium, because plutonium-239 is fissile, but there is a problem. Plutonium doesn't naturally exist.
That's a problem, yeah.
Yeah. So the way you make plutonium is you put uranium-238, which is inert. We use it in weapons because it's pyrophoric. It's why they make tank shells out of it and stuff like this, and there's all sorts of controversy about that, but essentially the reason we use it that way is because when it's finally divided into dust, it ignites, and so you shoot it at a tank, it forms a bunch of dust as it goes through the tank. It's very hard as well, so it penetrates things really well, and the dust ignites and kills everybody inside the tank, even though
it's a pretty brutal weapon.
It's a nasty weapon,
yeah.
Okay? Depleted uranium is nasty stuff, but what you do is you put uranium-238 under neutron bombardment, and the easiest, the best, and mostest way you do this is inside a nuclear reactor, and it goes through a multi-phase transmutation by capturing neutrons, becomes plutonium-239. Now, the problem with this process, and the reason that all of the crap about people using power reactors to make nuclear weapons is a lie... It's not an accident. It's a lie. Is that when you do this, you don't just get plutonium-239. There are other isotopes that you get. When you leave that 230, the uranium-238 in there for any material length of time, those undesirable isotopes become a larger and larger percentage of the whole. And one of them causes the weapon to go off before it is completely assembled. So when you set off the explosive, you get a fizzle. It's kind of like cutting the end off a firecracker and lighting it. It doesn't go kaboom. It just bzzz, you know, doesn't do anything useful. That obviously doesn't make for a good weapon. Okay, so that's a problem. But there's two other problems. There's two other isotopes that also get created, one of which produces a great deal of heat. And the second one produces a lot of very high-level radiation. So if you have that in the stuff and you go and you chemically separate it, it now kills anybody that tries to assemble the weapon and put the warhead on the missile or the bomb in the plane or whatever have you, right? So obviously you can't have any of those bad isotopes in the material or at least...
So it has to be pretty pure.
It has to be almost completely pure.
What do you say we go to a quick break here because we didn't do one earlier? Market's not moving that much, but there's enough to talk about. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Blowing up like Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamar, Ricky on the board. S&P Futures up 29. NASDAQ Futures up 108. This is after yesterday's total debacle where the Dow was down 739, the S&P's down 103, and NASDAQ down 404. So yesterday was really bad and pretty much closed on its low. So we didn't get any break on the close either. So today the Nikkei down 633, that's 1.2%. Hang Seng down 251, that's like 1% even. Shanghai down 33, that's 0.8%. It's the biggest move they've had in a bit. We're in Europe. We've got the DAX up 11. They were down yesterday. The FTSE up 17.1%. CAC round up 1, call that flat. So slightly above ground over there. Bonds were down 1 basis point on the 10-year, but the 10-year is pretty seriously above. It was under 4 when this all started. Now it's 4.25. So bonds, interest rates are going like the wrong way for the administration here. I don't think they're happy about that. Oil down $1.74, $93.99. So it did touch 100, but now it's back down to like 94. That's West Texas Brent is 99.54. So that's still at 100. That's British oil is up. That's down 98 cents, back under 100. So when they say oil holds near 100, they're talking about Brent, not West Texas. Gold down $10, $51.55. Gold is actually down on the week. Part of that is because they don't think rates are going to get cut. Well, we'll see. Silver down $1, $84. Foreign exchange. Dollar is a second weekly rise here. So the euro is under 115 now, 114.7. British pound 132.4, so the dollar's gotten a lot stronger. Crypto is up 2,000. I'm not sure exactly why. Maybe Carl is just why crypto is racing up here, 72,452, when gold sort of isn't. It's kind of odd. Ricky, what do you got for us? Quick traffic, weather, sports. Bulls suck.
Good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:32 here in Chicago. We're looking at 43 degrees right now with a high of 48. Winds gusting past 45 miles per hour today. Clouds and some sunshine as well. Tonight will be breezy, otherwise mostly cloudy with a low of 33 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 62 degrees right now with a high of 94. Sunny and hot, so caution if doing strenuous activities outside. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago really quick. Inbound lanes are starting to back up a little bit. Slow traffic on exit ramp to then Ryan from Stevenson. There's an accident on exit ramp on Reagan Memorial East at Roosevelt Road, and also there's traffic on Eisenhower starting at 25th Avenue. This is all inbound. Sports real quick. MLB spring training yesterday, the Cubs beat Mariners 7-4, and Diamondbacks lose to Rockies 13-2. White Sox also tie with Giants 3-3, and today we got Cubs White Sox at 3:05 p.m. and Diamondbacks Royals at 8:05 p.m. Yesterday we had the Blackhawks beat Utah Mammoth 3-2. And for the NBA, lastly, we got Suns beating Pacers yesterday, 123-108, and Bulls lose to Lakers, 142-130. Today we got Suns at Raptors and Bulls at Clippers. Back over to you, Chief.
Carl, who the hell named the Utah team the Mammoth?
Who knows? So, you know, I want to go back to some of the scams and the fraud stuff, okay?
God, where you want to start with that?
because of course it's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
But I need to finish this thing with this scam that got us into this war, okay?
Yeah.
Which is the stuff about the nuclear stuff. All right. The reality is a power reactor only makes money when it's running, right? I mean, that should be obvious.
Yeah.
Right? And it takes quite a while to shut one down because you have to turn it off, you have to let it cool, you have to provide supplementary cooling after it's off because the decay heat is very significant. The higher the power level of the output, the more of that there is. And therefore, nobody in their right mind ever would use a power reactor to produce weapons material, ever. By the way, may I point out that the reactor at Dimona in Israel does not produce electrical power. Gee, I wonder why not.
Yeah.
I wonder what they use that for. By the way, the same. This is not entirely about weapons. The same thing is true if you want to make medical isotopes like cobalt-60 for radiotherapy. Okay, so it is. But the point being that the lie that was told by Witkoff, our government's official representatives, all over the media, as the reason that we started this, whether Bibi Netanyahu was the one who provoked it or we were the one, leave that aside. The excuse was that there was no civilian purpose for enriching uranium beyond 20%. That is a lie.
Sure it is.
There is every reason to do it if you want to close the fuel cycle and recycle your own waste back into a reactor to burn it up, which is the only sane thing to do with it. All right? You must have enriched uranium for the parts of the cycle that produce
new
fuel.
You also need it to do radical medical stuff, don't you?
Well, it's the same thing because you have to short cycle fuel. Okay? So, by the way, anybody that says that I'm full of blankety blank on this, may I point out that the United States ran Fermi 1 in Monroe, Michigan. That's the one that nearly melted down and blew up. We did it. It technically produced power, a very small amount. I think it's the maximum it ever actually made in electricity was like 70 megawatts, which is like nothing. A typical power reactor makes a gigawatt. Okay. yes, it had a generating end on the back end of it, but the purpose for that reactor was to be part of a closed fuel cycle, which is what Carter destroyed with his executive orders. That was the reason it existed.
Yep. Well, I think that just you don't even almost have to get to the political piece of this. I mean, on what side you have the president one day saying, the Straits we'll be done with this in a few days.
Oh yeah, and that obviously didn't work.
And then all of a sudden he says, "Well, we're going to be pulling oil out of strategic reserve for 4 months." Right. And then forget the part about how much he bitched that Biden pulled oil out of strategic reserve. But the thing that is there's all kinds of stuff here that doesn't necessarily match for me, Carl. When we pulled this before we invaded, well, when Iraq war. When we went into Iraq, we were getting January core inflation was 3.1%, so that's higher than we're supposed to have been, I think. But this is the PCE because we don't have any detail on it. We don't. Fourth quarter GDP revised down to just 0.7% growth. That's right. Not good. And even core inflation was 3.1%. That's high. So those are two crummy numbers. But now we allegedly are about even on what we use and what we produce. So, it's to be perfectly blunt, the Strait of Hormuz is not near as important to us as it was then. I'm going to say the Bush administration.
Well, it's not important to us, it's important to a lot of other
people. I understand that. But I'm saying, but during the Bush administration, I'm going to say we imported 50% of our oil, 45 to 55%, something in there, right?
Yeah.
And now we allegedly. Other than stuff coming here and diesel going out that you talked about the other day, I mean, somebody was on last night, some trucker paid, fill up their truck, and I don't know where the hell it was, $6, it cost them $800 or something to fill up their truck, and they're like, I'm shutting it down. I can't make any money there.
Right.
Because some of these guys are right on the edge, and these drivers and these vehicles. But, I mean, I don't, why the surge in gasoline price, now we're coming from a lower level, I get that. Why the surge in gasoline and diesel price here is just as bad as it was when we imported half our oil. What's going on here? The number that should not happen, should it?
Well, this is this really is about our government, and this is something that Trump could end in an hour, but he refuses to do it, and that, by the way, is a complete crock of crap. All right, and that is the export of two things. Number one. Is we are exporting diesel, all right? We didn't used to do this, It was the reason that diesel fuel was always cheaper, because it's the same thing as heating oil. Chemically, it's identical. It's just taxed different.
It's got a couple additives, but other than that, you're right.
So does gasoline.
Yeah,
okay, they put
yeah.
the additives in when they load the tanker that goes to the gas station to fill it.
I mean, if you poured stuff from your heating oil into a modern diesel, you're probably going to gum it up a little bit because it doesn't have the additives.
No, not anymore. Because now all we make is ULSD.
Okay, all right.
Okay,
so we don't make regular heating oil anymore.
No, literally, the only difference now is the dye and the tax.
So you're saying in the Northeast, where they still have all these people with oil heat, they're getting regular diesel like from the gas station?
Yeah, because it's dyed red, but because it's not taxed, it doesn't have road tax on it.
Okay.
And they dye it red because if you put it in a road vehicle and you get stopped and checked, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's the...
I remember people would had heating oil would take a few gallons and put it in their old Mercedes putt-putt.
Well, we used to... I mean, I owned a diesel-powered boat, all right? So, I mean, the fuel that it burned was dyed. But, I mean, it would have run perfectly well in a diesel car. It just, you know, it's seriously illegal to do that. So, you know, there you go.
But I think a lot of what it appears, and again, let's hope it all works out, but, I absolutely do understand that the Iranian leadership view of the world, religion puts their thumb on top of everybody, is absolutely as far away you can get from our view of the world, or at least our official view of the world.
Well, no, we're not the only, the Muslims out of Iran are not the only ones who do this.
I understand, but I'm saying that, I guess the Catholics did it in the 800s too, right? You know, but I mean,
the Christians do it today. By the way, so do the Jews. Jews. So do some Christians.
Right.
And incidentally, any concept of dispensationalism is inherently part of this. If you are wrapping a violent political philosophy in the cloak of religion to try to evade the idea that the two are not the same thing, we shouldn't let you into this country. And if you're here, we should throw you out if you came here under false pretense.
Now,
if you're a natural-born citizen, I can't do that. But if you were naturalized or you're here on some kind of a green card, out now.
Well, I probably told a story on the show before. I grew up Southside Catholic guy, right? Well, for years, my church is St. John Fisher. That's where I went to grammar school. We moved to St. Bernadette's, right? And once in a while, I'd go to church there when I wasn't playing softball. when you go to Sunday Mass, it's different than going to, like, you know, the Basilica at Notre Dame, where the guy has spent a week on his 10-minute homily, right? And it's serious stuff. I mean, and these guys are giving a real speech. At a parish church, when you got the families there, they're sort of not doing that, right? I mean, they'll talk about the gospel a little bit and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's not bad. It's just, you know, it's not the same thing. Well, they get this visiting priest there one day. And this guy, you could tell he's really educated. And he must have thought he was at Holy Name or someplace instead of St. Bernard. He's starting to launch into wartime. And he goes, "More wars over economics have been fought in the name of religion than anything else." The place is like going, "Who's this guy?" Of course, everything he said was stone cold true, I thought, because I'd heard a lot of stuff like that at Notre Dame and places. So I mean, I'm thinking this guy's like really good. He's never get invited back, and I never did see him again. But he's right. I mean, wars are fought in the name of it. But the you could make the historical thing. It was made in the book The Catastrophe, that the Muslim religion was very opportunistic. It was right near the end of the Roman Empire was falling apart, partly due to Black Plague, partly due to lead pipes, partly due to God knows what else, corruption. And these guys took advantage. So the idea of the religion was, part of the religion is to conquer people and, by the way, make them your religion, but by the way, take their stuff while you're doing it. And that was kind of they're not the first religion to have done that, but...
No, it's and there won't be the last.
Yeah.
But my entire point is that this, you know, when we look at what's, like, you look at the energy situation right now, okay? You know, oil is of course a global commodity, right? So,
yep.
And but if you look at the term structure in the QM futures, you'll see that the trading community does not believe that this is going to be a year-long or two-year-long or five-year-long adventure.
But they don't think it's going to be a two-week adventure either.
Well, they also don't think it's going to be a two-week adventure. Yeah. Otherwise, the front-month contract wouldn't be trading where it is, and it is.
Yep.
Okay. However, if you look out further down the line, you will see that, this too shall pass, at least in from the standpoint of the people who are putting real money on the line when they place their bets. Okay, well, when they're wrong, they lose.
You know, it's very similar, Carol, when I got in the business, when the interest rates were, CDs were 15%.
Yeah.
Okay, but if you went out and bought a 30-year bond,
it wasn't.
It was right. 12. So, but right. It's sort of like the oil thing now. We don't know who, we don't know how, but somewhere in the future, somebody's going to wake up and fix this. that's really what it's saying, right?
Yeah, essentially. And, yeah. and the point that I have repeatedly made on this whole thing is that we have a serious issue here within the United States today when it comes to energy supplies. We have done a bunch of very stupid things. Exporting LNG is one of them. Exporting diesel is another. Yeah, we are now in a wartime posture. By the way, I have no idea what just hit the tape, but something did in the last couple of minutes because the futures are ripping higher.
It's doubled up.
Yeah, they're ripping higher, and I don't know why.
This is after the GDP number. Well, maybe the growth number.
Well, now, afterwards. So,
but,
I mean,
because I mean, normally you would look at that and say, well, bad news means that the Fed's going to cut, but I don't know if that's.
Well, that was 8:30. Yeah. Okay, it's 8:45, so I don't know what's going on here. Anyway.
Gold and silver just spiked up too.
Yeah, it seems to and the other thing that's interesting is that the curve flattened up a little bit too. So that's
well, yeah. It's hard to generalize politics, but it seems like a lot of people, even the Trump followers, if you corner them, they'll say whatever they're doing sure doesn't look like it was all that well thought out.
Well, no, that's the point, is that I look at this and I say, look, if you were going to get involved in this, okay, regardless of, first off, running this tired trope about they're 2 weeks away from having a nuclear bomb, and that's why we did it.
They've been doing that for 40 years.
And guess what? Essentially my entire adult life, and it's been a lie the entire time. And when I was young, I believed it because I didn't know enough. I hadn't learned enough from a standpoint of physics to understand why it was a lie. Now I do understand why it is a lie, and so I've been raising a stink about it for quite a long period of time every time that trope gets run. But the thing is that irrespective of the justification that is trotted out, the fact of the matter is that if you have a brain in your head, you know that there are always going to be unintended consequences that you do not have control over when you do something.
Cry havoc and let loose the dogs of war. You never know how they're coming back, do you?
Well, that's part of the thing. But there are things you can control. One of the things that Trump could have done under the DPA, and he has the unitary authority to do it, is to slam the door on the LNG exports and to slam the door on the diesel exports. And by doing so, control the impact on Americans when it comes to energy prices. Now, that's not going to help anybody over in Europe.
No.
Okay? In fact, it might make it worse over there. But that's their problem.
How much money is his buddy who bought the refineries out of bankruptcy 2 weeks before we did our deed in Venezuela? How much guys?
Well, there's this, I'm sure, Chief, but I don't know how many of the listeners know this. Refineries are set up to run specific grades of oil.
Yep.
You cannot just take the oil that comes from Iran, for example, and throw it into a refinery that's set up to run Venezuelan crude and have it work. It doesn't work like that, okay? They're set up to run different things. Now, can you retool them? Yes, but it's expensive and it takes time. You have to shut
everything
down.
It takes a long time, because the stuff that's thick, you have to heat every pipe or it won't flow.
Yeah, and it's expensive too, and the catalytic units are different. I mean, there's
Carl, can I give you a? I know we launch into specifics because both of us love the detail, but just generic question: why the what was the name of the pipeline that was supposed to be built, and then Biden conked it or stopped it, or was Obama?
Oh God, I don't remember the name.
The one that went over the Ogallala Aquifer, and it was a big deal. And whether you think it was a good idea, bad idea, you know, it's. But you know, it's funny. I have not talked to one person. Usually, if you're a full right winger, that's one of your things. Oh man, look at Biden stopped this pipeline. It was going to be great for everybody.
Keystone XL.
And now one person. If I asked a couple of, you know, again, you can't bury everybody with details because you and I do this. Other people don't because they got real life. Well, we have real lives too, but we're closer to what's going on. So I said, you know, how did you think you were going to benefit from that oil? Oh yeah. Well, when the oil went down to whatever, wasn't the spot price of the tar sands oil like $2 a barrel? You couldn't give it away, right? Because it's the heavy. Sandy right. crap, very similar to the Venezuelan oil, correct?
Yep.
So the idea was, would we build a pipeline from Canada to these refineries that are set up to do it on the Gulf? There's no way you can run that into Whiting. There's no way you can run that into the one out in, was it Bolingbrook or Joliet?
Right, it won't work. Right.
It won't work. But nobody knew that. Every person I talked to would have massive opinions on this, and nobody knew it. I said, you know, that's, that oil is not for you. Well, sure it is. No, it's not.
I mean, right.
No, it's not. And then the weird part is the Trump, at the time, he said we're going to use only, what, American pipelines or something?
American steel.
Well, it turns out the steel that he was buying was this Russian guy owned this Canadian company.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't believe anything any of these people say.
Well, yeah, it's all BS.
It's all money. It's all. I mean, is there a Solomon in our future, a Lincoln or a Roosevelt or somebody that can't be bought? I mean, I don't.
You know, the thing is that Chief, you know, everybody loves to go after Waltz, right? Which, you know, I mean, that's his own fault. He's dumb as a box of rocks, and he deserves everything he got. On the other hand. You know, as Fox News just pointed out, and by the way, CBS has picked up on this, this hospice scam out in California is, you know, is effing ridiculous, all right? Gets uncovered because this, you know, this woman, Medicare refuses to pay because they say she's dying.
I mean, there's
the... Right? But the thing is this, Chief, this is the essence of the issue, is that we have, it doesn't matter what the issue is in the modern, you know, in the modern lexicon, okay? Whether it's energy, whether it's weapons procurement. I pointed out when this, you know, when the Russia-Ukraine thing, you know, went on for any material length of time, that it became very obvious very quickly that both sides had realized that you can buy the materials, the necessary control electronics, on the open market for drones that can be completely autonomous once launched. In other words, they need nothing from command and control for literally under $100.
Did you catch the stuff yesterday that the thing that is saving us in our fight against the drones, since we were using fighter aircraft to shoot them down, we've actually recruited a bunch of guys from Ukraine that have figured out how to do this a lot cheaper with like nets and other stuff, and now they're teaching our guys how to do it.
Yeah, well, but the basic problem is this: if I can build 100,000 of these things, okay, or 1 million of these things for the cost of one submarine, right? And I can, by the way. And the necessary components are commodities that can be bought anywhere by anyone.
A little propeller, a little guidance system, and off you go.
Well, I mean, I can buy literally $10 GPS chips now, right? I mean, that's no BS. I've got one in my garage and I use it as a clock source.
You use it so you can find your garage.
No, I use it as a clock source because GPS has timing. Okay, so it's a timing source for my network here at the house.
Really? Okay.
That's its purpose. Now, of course, it also tells you where it is. I already know that. But, you know.
I was going to say, I hope you don't hope to reference it too often after a couple of cocktails.
But its purpose is it provides, you know, several nanosecond accurate time chirps.
I'm having trouble here. Carl with a couple of scotches said, I'll reference my GPS to get myself out to the garage.
Figuring out how to get back to the house. Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing is that, so, I mean, these are such insanely cheap commodity items now in an INU, which can't be jammed because it's inertial. It doesn't use a satellite signal.
Okay, they're available, but to Iran, where do they get them?
Well, you can buy a chief. They're literally purchasing. They're not controlled.
I know, but
items.
But they're not right now. It was like yesterday. I had the conversation with Lou. It wasn't Lou. Who the hell was it? Said no. They're talking about mining the harbor. Mining, you know,
right.
The Houthis are mining the bottom end of the Red Sea. Hey, where do you go buy a mine? I mean, are they heavy? How do you have to transport them? I don't know why. I always dig into the detail, which I know aggravates the hell out of people.
Well, you just have to make... All you have to do is make the explosives. Actually making a mine is not very hard.
But, I mean, the ones in World War II, the big things with the spikes on them and the chains, I mean, are they still that? Are you still... I mean, this is not something you can have tomorrow. I mean, there's no mine store you go buy. I mean, there's people...
Well, I don't think there is.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this stuff, it's everything seems like it's easy to people. You know, I'll say, boy, where'd you get that? Well, you just go to the internet and get it. Well, wait a minute. The thing weighs 1,000 pounds or 800 pounds, and you got to get it out in the water. I mean, everybody's convinced that all this stuff is so... I don't think it's all that easy to make a good mine, do you?
Well, I don't think it's very difficult to make a mine. I mean, you know, again, proximity, you know, most mines, I mean, even back in World War II, very few of them were contact explosives. They were proximity explosives.
Okay.
They sensed the magnetic material, okay, because a ship is typically made out of metal, right?
Well, that's why I want minesweepers are made out of wood.
Well, right, exactly. But they, I mean, like today, I happen to have here, you know, little $5 breakout boards that have Hall effect sensors on them that detect any kind of ferrous metal that gets reasonably close. Now, of course, those are designed for things like a magnetic switch on a door or something like that, right? So, I mean, they're, you know, they have to be really close. But the actual electronic sensing component of that is, you know, 50 cents at DigiKey.
they cost no money. Either Trump or Biden in the last 2 years, since we're not worried about mines, some outfit in, I actually went by this place when I was a kid, it's in Sturgeon Bay or somewhere up there, they make the minesweepers. And they were supposed to be making four of them, they canceled two of them. And Wayne, who was in the Navy yesterday, we heard him talking about how they retired a couple of them when he was in the Navy.
Oh, yeah, because that's never going to be a problem again.
And he said, I said, how do you get one of those things across the ocean? They're made out of wood. They're not that big. He goes, funny you should mention that. I was on one, we brought one home from Denmark or someplace over the open ocean. He goes, and we hit this storm. He goes, everybody, even the captain, was barfing. He goes, it was awful. It's not exactly an aircraft carrier. The thing's wooden.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, but this is, and now, you know, I assume that the modern way to do this probably doesn't involve wooden minesweepers. It probably involves ROVs that are remote, so you don't actually have sailors that are in harm's way in case something goes wrong and one goes off on you. But I mean, the idea that, you know, oh, nobody will ever do that. Yeah, sure they won't. But I assure you, if somebody fires off 1,000 autonomously operated drones that run on their own internal memory and such.
Drones like that simple? Those that simple and that light? What can they carry in terms of explosives?
All right, you're not talking about that light, okay? I mean, this is we're talking about something maybe costs, you know, 10 grand to build, right?
Well, so not the little dinky one you got driving flying around.
No, because that can only carry a pound worth of explosives or something like that, which is nothing, right? But, you know, you build these things, maybe you spend $10,000 on them, but they still, you know.
Do they look like a little drone or do they look like a small plane?
I would expect that most of these would probably look like a small aircraft. But, you know, I mean, you could probably get 50 or 100 pounds worth of high explosive in there. If you get one of those into an aircraft carrier hangar deck through the open elevator,
I mean, you're not going to sink it, but you're going to screw it up pretty good. And
well, I used to see some pretty good. There's a big model airplane flying field. It used to be on LaGrange Road. It's moved to Tinley Park, but some guys, there's some pretty big things up there. They weren't, you know, they were.
I used to fly those things when
I was younger. Well, they were like 4 feet across, 5 feet.
Yeah, You could put an explosive in one of those.
But now they got to be way more than 4 feet across. Are these things 20 feet across or 10?
But the thing is, that if you've got the ability to autonomously, you know, for the thing to autonomously operate, it doesn't have to be controlled by a human on the other end, right? By remote control, which, by the way, is not hard anymore.
Do you expect these things to come back, or do they just, can they land?
They're one shots. Okay. You launch them and they're gone. But I would, vision, machine vision that, is programmed, okay, that's an aircraft carrier. Find the hangar deck opening, go in there and explode.
Yeah.
That kind of thing is not very tough, okay?
It's like in Star Wars where the weakness was in the garbage chute.
Well, Chief, yeah. My doorbell has inside the doorbell. Okay, not because I've got one of those video style doorbells, right? But I have forbidden it to connect outside of my own house, so it cannot use any machine intelligence at any server or anything else, because I'm not going to let Amazon or any other company have access to my video feeds in my home. Okay, that ain't happening. Inside the logic in the doorbell. So you're talking about something that's a couple inches high and
so where does it go? Just goes to your computer?
Just goes to my machine. It has enough to be able to detect a human and differentiate between a human and a dog.
Well, the one in my alley does. It'll say human pet.
Right, but here's the thing. It doesn't. I don't know if yours is talking to Amazon server or something like that
to do
the actual analysis. Well, it probably is. Mine's not. That level of differentiation is happening inside that little itty bitty box.
So I got to talk to my IT guy now. You got me worried.
I'm saying anyone that thinks that this kind of stuff is difficult to do or requires a lot of money or anything like that. No, it don't. Not anymore. Okay. And it is absolutely commodity grade stuff that anyone can buy. There's no way to prevent Iran or anyone else from getting their hands on this.
I was saying, are shipments going from Taiwan to Iran today? You would think it's got to be pretty tough to do.
Well, I would assume that shipments went from Taiwan to Iran over the last 5 years.
Yeah, that I'm with you.
Are they getting stuff today? Well, I would think that's a relatively high risk adventure, right?
All right, we got a dash, but I will. I think I'll probably have to tap. We'll see what the stuff is. We'll tap a couple of guys for money. But John Lee might be calling in from Singapore. I don't know, but I'll tap you on Monday morning because John's got an appointment someplace.
I'll be around.
All right, bud. Have a good weekend. S&P futures up 33. NASDAQ futures up 120. Again, this is about a third of what we were down yesterday. So
don't ask me why either, because I certainly don't see a reason for
it. Well, we get a little bit of bounce back from last night. Last hour was pretty ugly.
Yep.
So we'll be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. Or back on Monday.
That's all, folks.